Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Harry Shearer has been making people think and making people laugh for a career that has spanned seven decades. Shearer started his career as a kid in the 1950s with parts on the Jack Benny program and Alfred Hitchcock Presents. As an adult, he would have stints on the cast and writing staff of Saturday Night Live, and he co-created and co-starred in the cult hit This Is Spinal Tap in 1984. He's also known for the astonishing range of characters he plays on the animated Fox series The Simpsons, from Ned Flanders to Kent Brockman to Dr. Hibbert and everybody's favorite villain, Montgomery Burns. In 2010, he directed a critically acclaimed investigative documentary on the preventable tragedy of the levee breaks in New Orleans following Hurricane Katrina. His latest project is a series called Nixon's The One. It's a verbatim reenactment of Richard Nixon's recorded words from the Oval Office. The series premiered last year on Britain's Sky Arts TV network, and it will debut for U.S. audiences on YouTube October 21st. He's in town to receive the Ernie Kovacs Award at the Video Fest Dallas this weekend, and we are delighted he could make time for us today. Harry, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much, and thank you for getting the thrust of the documentary right. So many people have inaccurately described it as about Katrina or about the aftermath of Katrina, and it's not. It's the film is called The Big Uneasy. NPR even forbade me to buy enhanced underwriting statements saying a documentary about why New Orleans flooded. So I'm delighted that you got it right.
Oh, well, thank you. You have described Richard Nixon as a self-made man and a self-destroyed man.
Yeah, perfect, isn't it?
It seems like for an artist, there's nothing that could be more tantalizing to explore.
Yeah, well, he was the quintessential 20th century American character, the ultimate self-made man. He came from this really humble background in rural Southern California and ends up, you know, top of the greasiest bowl in America. And then, you know, shoots himself in both feet and has to climb down from the pole. And I think part of the reason was that for both aspects of that, for both sides of that, the ascent and the descent, was that he had these burning resentments that just could never go away. He didn't have the let it go gene, you know. Yeah. There's a wonderful scene in one of the episodes where he's sitting with Henry Kissinger and he's just absolutely bitterly recalling the fact that during the John F. Kennedy administration, he was never invited once for a social event in the White House. And nobody bothers in any of these conversations to say, you know, sir, Kennedy's dead and you won the presidency. Let it go.
Yeah.
He just can't do it. And that's given the fact that he's not cosmetically attractive. He wasn't intelligent. The camera didn't love him. Mm-hmm. He didn't have that thing that politicians are supposed to have, which is the inborn gift for small talk and liking to be around strangers. He was every bit the opposite of that. He hated it, awkward with strangers. So those resentments, those fires that burned within him are, and his intelligence, are what propelled him to the top of the heap of this very difficult world of politics. And they are, of course, what led to the faults that led to his downfall, too.
Did you have to wait until you got old enough to convincingly play Richard Nixon at the end of his presidency?
No, I'm too old to play Nixon, believably, actually. But I've been basically doing Nixon as long as I've been doing anybody. I mean, I was in a comedy group when he was president, and when he passed away on my own radio show, I started doing this series of scenes with three conceits: A, that there's a place called heaven; B, that he got in; and C, he's still taping. So I've been working on it for a long time.
All right, let's listen to a little bit of the show here.
Hey, you're better looking than I am. Why'd you stay here? Blondes, they say, photograph better than brunette. Is that true or not?
I don't know, sir.
Or you are blonde, aren't you?
No, sir.
Redhead?
No, thinning.
We're the same.
That joking around is at a very strange moment. It is 6 minutes before he's about to make his speech resigning from the presidency of the United States. And he walks into this room where the crew is to televise his speech. And what does he start doing? This guy with no gift for small talk. He starts cracking jokes with the crew.
Bad jokes. And it's clear he's so uncomfortable, and we understand why he's so uncomfortable, right? This is this momentous time in his life. It's like the admission of his failure. It's cringeworthy. I mean, did you have to feel for him to play him, or do you have to avoid feeling for him in order to get the character right?
Well, you know, I grew up, the first person I worked for in show business was Jack Benny, the great comedy master of an earlier era. And you think about what his persona was, his comedy persona. He was a miser. He was vain. He was a bad boss. He was mean to his employees. Things that one would list and say, well, that's an unlikable guy. And yet he was lovable. He was beloved for decades in this country. So what was it? What was going on there? And I guess I osmosed a little bit because he never put his arm around me and say, here's how you do comedy, kid. That you play these people as flawed humans. You don't play them as stick figures or monsters or, you know, some abstract embodiment of evil or anything like that. You play them as flawed humans, terribly flawed humans, but humans. They're us. We're them. You know, you don't have to like him or get into any of that. You just play the humanity of it and let the stuff speak for itself. You don't have to underline it and go, oh, listen, here's where he does this. Here's where he hates these people. It's obvious what's going on. Play the guy. Just play the person. There are moments where, I mean, that scene that we just were listening to fascinated and baffled me for years for that very reason, the paradoxical nature of why would you choose not to just sit quietly waiting for your speech? Why would you choose to engage in this pathetic joke-making with these guys who are just standing still?
They don't quite know what to make of it either.
Their mouths are agape. They don't know what's going on. And while we were rehearsing, and I'd watched this scene for years. It's been on video, and it's been bootlegged around. And I just thought, goofy. I can't think of anything else. Finally, when we were rehearsing it, and again, you know, when you rehearse, you're having to inhabit the character and get connection to the humanity of whoever that is. And I had come upon the only words that were not in the tape while we were rehearsing. I found on the internet a memoir by a White House staffer who was in the room that night, and he provided the final words after Nixon finished his speech. As he's walking out the door, on August 8th, he says to the crew, "Have a Merry Christmas, fellas." And suddenly I got it. He was not in the moment of humiliation and mortification. He was already plotting his next campaign, his campaign for personal rehabilitation. And in his mind, these guys, these strangers, were going to go back to their friends and families that night and the next few days and say, he wasn't upset. He wasn't depressed. He wasn't angry. He was a nice guy. He was joking around. He even wished us a Merry Christmas. He was plotting the next campaign because that's who he was.
Well, you said you'd been playing Nixon, I would imagine, much more broadly for years. Did you have to sort of bring the character down? Because as I think people could hear there, really what you're going for is verisimilitude.
Yes. But also, when you're playing Nixon in satire, one was always playing most of the time was playing the public Nixon. Mm. And the public Nixon was very different, needless to say, from the private Nixon. And one had the tapes as a guide. You didn't have to imagine, okay, how he makes this change. You had the actual recording, and during the rehearsals, we would always be listening to the tape of the scene and as our guide for, okay, there's a pause here. He talks over him. All of that stuff, because it all comes from character. I realized when I did a take that I thought was good, but the words were slightly off from the text. And then I'd do another take corrected by my script supervisor and got the words right. Having the particular word order that Nixon chose for whatever reason, from whatever depth of his character, made me a better performer of him in that take. So the closer – we all kind of were able to agree that the closer we got to the reality of it, we got in this great gift. Nobody else in the world has ever recorded almost 5.5 years of their every waking word. It ain't going to happen again. Just as a comedy gift, you have to respect it.
You had to make the show in England instead of in the U.S. What happened when you presented it here and said, will you fund this?
I never did. I thought that the insistence on the real was going to be a little hard to swallow for network executives.
Like he's not skating in or wearing a dress or that kind
of
thing?
Yeah, and how is this comedy? And also I thought, I dreaded the inevitable meetings where some well-meaning executive would say, you know, almost apologetically, look, we know Nixon didn't like black people, but did he have to hate Jews too? Like they could rewrite it, you know?
Because today the audience wouldn't appreciate that.
Yeah, right. Well, it's not about – it's a, and by the way, it is about today because I think even though we'll never know, I can't imagine that world leaders are not having somewhat similar conversations, differing because they don't have the same personality quirks that Nixon did. But, you know, we clearly have had a run of peculiar world leaders ever since, you know, Saddam Hussein, Gaddafi, Tony Blair, you know, to name just a few.
So you mentioned that you worked, you did the Jack Benny radio show.
And the television show.
And the television show.
Yeah.
What did you, as a kid, I would imagine that your memories of that are really strong, even though you were very young, simply because at the time it was this novel experience.
Well, it was a novel experience. It was also a very welcome experience. I wasn't happy with the kid thing. It's true. I thought it was kind of lame.
Like you were ready to be out on your own.
Yeah, well, I wanted to be with the grown-ups. I thought they were having all the fun and they had all the power and they had all the everything. And so when the door opened at the age of 7 and I got to be not just with grown-ups but with the coolest grown-ups I could imagine being with, I mean, Jack Benny, Mel Blanc, the voice of Looney Tunes cartoons, I mean, all these wonderful people. And so you ask about my memories. Because I worked on a lot of other shows. I didn't just work for him. So I had a good experience in a lot of different parts of show business, movies and so forth. What lingers more than particular moments, although there's one moment where I made Jack Benny laugh for the first time, which I can see playing in my mind.
What did you say?
I just was doing a line, and I twisted it in a little way that made him just surprised him and made him hit the table and throw his head back and laugh. And I just went, more of that, please. Let me have a life full of that. But what lingers with me was the easy professionalism of that show. I've been in so many shows since then where people were tearing their hair out and getting, you know, it's the odd paradox is I've done medical shows and people are always joking around before they do these serious shows. And at comedy shows, there's grand opera backstage. You know? And the Benny show was, we know you know what you're doing. That's why you're here. Let's enjoy it. Let's have fun. Let's do it. Let's go home.
Yeah, that sounds so very adult.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, that's what lingers with me is just that the easy professionalism of people at the top of their craft, trusting other people at the top of their craft and letting me in.
Were you already doing voices as a kid?
I was putting myself to sleep doing my versions of my favorite shows.
Really?
Yeah. And I thought about it later and I thought, well, that must have sounded funny because I didn't have vocal equipment to do anything but this kid
right,
voice.
Before your voice had changed. Yeah.
Before my voice had changed. And then I thought about it and I realized what I was doing because kid play is work. Mm-hmm. I was training my ear. I couldn't train my voice, but I was already training my ear to like, oh, he sounds like this, he sounds like this, he sounds like this.
So do you observe voices now and think to yourself, I want to do something with that? And how do you sort of file those away?
I can't set targets. There are people that have always defied me in terms of I would love to be able to do a really wickedly funny Geraldo Rivera. Never happened. You know, I did him once on my radio show and gave up. And then there are people like I finally, a couple weeks ago, I did for my show, my radio show.
Le Show.
Mm-hmm. A debate between 1971 John Kerry and 2014 John Kerry. And it was moderated by Bob Schieffer. I finally got my Bob Schieffer done.
We're speaking this hour with actor, writer, and director Harry Shearer. He's in town to receive the Ernie Kovacs Award at Dallas Video Fest 27, and he's got a new series out that debuts on YouTube October 21st called Nixon's the One. We'll resume our conversation in a couple of minutes. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education with courses in art, culture, history, communication, photography, and film studies. Registration online at smu.edu/think.
That is Give Me Some Money from the soundtrack for This Is Spinal Tap. My guest, Harry Shearer, co-created, co-wrote, and co-starred in the film, which came out in 1984. Harry Shearer is in town to receive the Ernie Kovacs Award at Dallas Video Fest 27. If you'd like to join the conversation, call us at 1-800-933-5372. I hear that clip, and then I think about A Mighty Wind. Do you think any artistic medium, any artistic genre, is there anything that's above parody? Anything that's sacred?
I don't think there's anything sacred. I think one has to be careful about how one approaches certain subjects. For example, we were talking during the break about I'd been fascinated by the O.J. trial. It was one of the great dramas in Southern California where I came up. And one couldn't be funny about the crime, the act at the heart of it. That's off limits. But there was a circus that grew up in the wake of it that followed it and that lasted for a good couple of years. And I thought that was a feast to me. You know, now I just heard, I was in Los Angeles, they're going to do a TV miniseries based on the O.J. trial. So now they're going to be making not fun of it. But I just thought, you know, that parade of characters from what book did those people walk out of? Lance Ito and all those folks whose names I'm sorry to say I can still remember.
Think of all the famous people that are famous today because they even just covered the trial.
Greta, who has a very successful show on Fox. She started out as a legal commentator on CNN covering that trial.
And did O.J. give us the Kardashians?
O.J. gave us the Kardashians, yes, he did indeed. And I would be sitting in the civil trial. The criminal trial, of course, was on television, but the civil trial wasn't, but it was in my neighborhood. And I thought, I'm not going to miss the second chapter of this. And so I got press pass and covered it. And there was a legal correspondent for NBC at the time, Star Jones, who was a friend of O.J.'s, who was sitting right behind me. So during the breaks in the trial, O.J. would come hover over me talking to Star Jones, and I was mentally digging, you know, my way to China while that was happening.
I mean, it has to be surreal. And did you have to make a decision in covering this as a journalist? I mean, did you have to make decisions about things that you just couldn't even talk about because you couldn't put them in the proper context?
No. My approach to that was, I guess, sort of what passes. I wouldn't even characterize it. My idea was I'm just going to act as if you've watched the television show of the first trial. You're not getting television of the second trial. I'm going to be vivid enough that it's like you're watching the television of the second trial, but with a guy who's sitting next to you going, did you see that? Giving you the elbow every once in a while, pointing your attention to something you might have missed. So that was my approach.
What's your news diet like now?
Very un-American. Newspapers, I read American papers. I read the Washington Post and the New York Times. I read the Guardian in London and the Telegraph because one is left and one is right. I read the Age from Australia. I read papers from New Orleans because that's my hometown at this point. I read stuff about L.A. because I used to live there and still maintain an interest there. My broadcast diet is BBC and Al Jazeera because they have the – when stuff happens in some unforeseen corner of the world, they seem to have people who are already there and who know the language and who are on the ground, as opposed to, I remember on Nightly News, the last time I saw it a few years ago, there was a story in Pakistan and they went to their correspondent in London for coverage of it. And I thought, well, he's reading the same AP wire I can read.
Right.
You know, it's just they got a different background on the camera shot, but that's it. So as the money has been drying up for journalism in this country, for actual journalism, and the news hole gets filled with more piffle, it's harder and harder. You know, we got told we were living in the information age, and we're not. We're living in the age of something that masquerades as information too much of the time.
Do you deliberately seek out things that you think will make you angry?
No, the world is very generous in supplying me with that without any effort on my part whatsoever. I thank the world every day for that.
Well, so many people are familiar with your work on The Simpsons. Mm. Let's listen here to a little Burns montage.
There are cities in Michigan Oh, shut up.
I read in the paper the other day there's a doctor in Europe who claims love is a disease and that he can vaccinate you against it.
You may shake my hand if you like.
We heard there Ronald Reagan, Lionel Barrymore, and then Montgomery Burns.
Ah, I see what you did there.
Yeah, will you explain why we picked this?
Because you heard some vocal similarity.
Well,
or suspected some.
They sound familiar, and I've heard that you thought about those two performers, or a politician, performer turned politician, and an actor, and then turned those into Burns?
I don't know if I thought about it beforehand. I may have thought about it after I did it. I don't tend to, contrary to the name of your program, do a lot of thinking before I choose, if I'm not doing a known person. In the case of The Simpsons, I think I just – my recollection way back 26 years ago was that I made sort of intuitive leaps. And then when somebody asked me about it, I said, well, sort of I thought about that. But I don't think I really did a lot of analytical work in trying to devise these voices. I don't think that really helps you. The only time I had to do that was I was running out of ideas. I was running out of made-up voices. So the only two that I really have any memory of resorting to the real world for reference points were for Principal Skinner. I had just done a television piece for a show on Cinemax about a former CBS News correspondent who used to go on the road, Charles Carroll. And I just sort of sped him up and slowed him and dropped him in pitch a little bit to make Principal Skinner. And I was aware of doing that. I just needed another starting point. The one that really has some relationship was for Reverend Lovejoy. I had done a show where I'd done a fairly, I thought, vivid impersonation of the TV evangelist Ernest Angley. And so, again, I just dropped him in pitch a little bit and slowed him down to get the Reverend Lovejoy. There's news about Ernest Angley this week from the Ohio newspapers that is, if for close observers, not surprising, but is certainly disheartening.
I actually haven't heard that news.
Yeah, he's being accused of cult-like behavior and forcing members of his church to get vasectomies and abortions and all sorts of weird stuff.
Oh, goodness.
Yeah.
Do you ever, when the characters were first being created, did you have to remind yourself, okay, this is the guy who talks like this? Or once you had it, was it in your brain?
Well, there was an interregnum, thank you very much, from the first season to the second. And I don't think the show had even been on the air yet. In any case, this happened to both Dan Castellaneta, who does Homer, and me. We came back for the second season not having really checked the references. So his Homer and my Mr. Burns migrated a little bit vocally between the first and second seasons. Everybody else I had kind of kept in mind, but Burns, for whatever reason, told me, no, I want to be here.
And people may or may not know this. You play both Burns and his hapless assistant, Smithers. Mm-hmm. And sometimes...
His lovelorn assistant.
His lovelorn assistant. Oh, poor, I know. Poor Smithers.
Yeah.
Sometimes you are both characters mm-hmm. within the same scene.
Good morning, sir. To make up for my failure last night, I alphabetized your breakfast. You can start with the waffles and work your way up to the zwieback. And to prevent newsprint from rubbing off on your hands, I've laminated today's newspaper.
I appreciate the thought, but my pen won't write on this. How am I supposed to do the junior jumble?
Oh, I can't even grovel properly. I'm a buffoon. I don't deserve to live on your planet anymore.
Pull yourself together, man. I dare say you're in need of a long vacation.
No, don't make me take a vacation. Without you, I'll wither and die.
That's a risk I'm willing to take.
But what would you do without me, sir?
Harry Shearer as Montgomery Burns and Smithers from The Simpsons. Are you using your body in different ways as you act out each of those characters?
I don't know. I've never watched myself do it.
You don't. You're not conscious of moving
no,
in any particular
no,
way?
No. I'm putting all my energy into the vocal interpretation because that's all that is going to carry the emotion or the joke or whatever that I'm doing. So if I'm doing it, it's totally accidental, and I don't try to do it, and it doesn't help me do the character, I don't think.
I was thinking about this when you're playing a scene with yourself, mm-hmm. and you do these in real time.
Mm-hmm.
Is that correct?
Yeah.
On the one hand, you've got like every actor's dream, right? You set up, your co-actor sets yourself up. But I wonder if you ever have to sacrifice and think, well, this scene really belongs to Smithers or this one belongs to Burns. And
No, I don't make those kinds of, again, I don't think.
All right, the hour's got to come to a close.
No, it's. I'm a very unanalytical performer in that sense. I think about the movie pieces I've done, or I just came out of this play in England where I was on stage for 2 hours and a very dark and serious play.
This is a one-man show.
No, it was three-person show, a play about characters that very much resemble my parents in some ways. If in a large piece, you have to think about what the meanings are and stuff like that. But I never think about, well, whose scene is this and who's got the baton and who doesn't and who's setting up who. It's just play the stuff, play what's there. Think about what, if you have the time. I mean, in a television show, you don't necessarily have the time to do a lot of thinking. That's why I like the play so much, to do a lot of thinking about what these characters are going through. In terms of how many different interpretations there might be for a particular line. But whatever occurs to you that's going on with them, you play that. You don't play, oh, but this is leading to this, or that's he's going to go there. You just have to be, at that moment, that person being that, doing that.
So many people, at least in the United States and probably in other parts of the world where this show is aired, at least in English, they have their favorite Simpsons like taglines, mm-hmm. and things that they say over and over. There are jokes in my house about the things that I repeat ad nauseum from The Simpsons.
Excellent.
Yeah, my favorite is actually when in the episode where there's a parody of It's a Wonderful Life, mm-hmm. and everybody is giving money, and then Montgomery Burns comes in and he says, "Does anyone have change for a button?" But I wonder, you can't really do that, right? Because you're the guy, or do you? You know what I mean? Like, you can't pull out Simpsons lines and...
No. But, I mean, it's true of Spinal Tap, too. I mean, people come up to me and will repeat Spinal Tap lines, and they've seen the movie far more recently than I have. You know?
Probably care about it more.
Well, I love it. I love those characters. I love Derek in the way that one man can love another. But I haven't watched it in a long, 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 long time, so it's not front of mind for me. I mean... what I love is that when we've had to do concerts and other stuff in years subsequent to the movie, one has had the opportunity to play the character again and carry him forward in time and so renew his acquaintanceship in a certain way.
I'm always fascinated by the fact that there are some incredibly good actors who aren't necessarily good at improvisation.
Oh, yeah. It's two different things. I mean, it's not. It is and it isn't. Improvisation, you know, the first thing I ever say about it is it's different from ad-libbing. Mm-hmm. Ad-libbing is about talking. Improvisation is about listening. Now, theoretically, a good actor is a good listener anyway. But improvisation is a special set of skills, I guess, that grow out of listening and then follow on and build on what you've just heard. I was never trained in improvisation. Look at me, and now I'm making hand gestures like you.
I do it all the time. We're on the radio.
Yeah. But I was never trained in improvisation. I watched improv groups that I really loved. But the first time I ever improvised professionally was in Spinal Tap, the comedy group I was with in the 70s, the Credibility Gap. We always wrote our sketches. We never improvised. So Spinal Tap was a departure for me. And, you know, I guess it was a leap because I wasn't trained. And it wasn't because we wanted to make an improvisational movie. We just knew we wanted to make a movie about this tour and frame it as a documentary, and what was the most real-looking way of doing that. Not saying written lines, but just letting, you know, catching it as it was. And that was on us to make it look like that. So it was a means to an end.
Was mockumentary even a word back then?
I don't think so. I think rockumentary was a word back then.
Rockumentary, yeah.
You know, like Rocktober.
Right. That, by the way, is like my pet peeve. Everything's Rocktober or spooktacular.
Yeah. Hey, it's my opportunity to say happy Rocktober, Dallas.
Thank you. We'll have to make a drop with that.
Yeah.
Let's go to the phones now. 1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Bob on the line in Dallas. Hey, Bob.
Hey, Harry. It's a pleasure and honor to speak with you.
Thank you.
I'm just wondering, what is your favorite outlet? Well, what is your favorite creative outlet? And should KERA be on the Apologies of the Week for not featuring the show?
I'm glad you asked Harry yeah. that and didn't pose it to me.
Yeah. From your mouth to their ears. as to my favorite artistic, you know, I for years I'd be asked this question, what do you like doing? And I'd say, well, all of it, because that's why I do all of it. But there was a year about 4 years ago when I had done one musical project after another. I did a live thing from my second record, and then we did a Spinal Tap record, and then we did the Unweek tour with Michael and Chris and I doing music from Spinal Tap and Mighty Wind, but not in character as ourselves. And then I did one other, and I was in August of that year, and I looked back and I thought, I've never been happier. I've just been doing music for 8 months. And I realized, you know, if they had to take everything else away, I'd keep my bass. And you get to go to a different place when you play music. And I like that place.
Did it ever occur to you to just be a musician?
Oh, no. I'm not good enough. My wife is a fabulous singer, songwriter, piano player, pianist. I live with somebody who's, you know, yards and yards above me in musical talent. So I know what the difference is. But I enjoy it.
My guest is writer, actor, director, and musician, Harry Shearer. He's in town to receive the Ernie Kovacs Award at Dallas Video Fest 27. His new series, Nixon's The One, debuts on YouTube October 21st. We'll come back to the conversation in a couple of minutes. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education with courses in art, culture, history, communication, photography, and film studies. Registration online at smu.edu/think.
I came to a realization that I was and am a blonde female folk singer trapped in the body of a bald male folk singer, and I had to let me out or I would die.
When you put it that way, it's almost poetry.
Mm. Almost.
Now they don't allow no frowns inside, leave them by the door. There's apple brandy by the keg
and sawdust on the floor.
So if you've got hankering, I'll tell you where to go.
Just look for the busted neon sign that flashes
E-A-O's.
That was my guest, Harry Shearer, as Mark Shubb at the end of A Mighty Wind, the folk music mockumentary from 2003. That just seemed like a blast.
Oh,
that,
my God. I can't tell you how many people come up to me and say E-A-O. So I have to always be ready for
Sorry,
that.
Sorry, ma'am, are you having a stroke? Or
Yes, exactly. But the movie was a blast, and then all three groups in the film toured for a concert tour on the East and West Coasts. And 12 of us were having the time of our lives and would still be doing that. And one of us had uncurable stage fright and just went, I'm not having any fun. Let's stop doing this. It was so great because we were taking the characters. This was, unlike Spinal Tap, where it was 8 years before we were live in concert. This was like within 2 months after the movie came out. So really right after people saw the movie, here we were. They were part of the movie now. And we had moved the story just a little forward for the characters. And Chris Guest, who directed the movie, was now just a player in one of the bands. He had no, you know, totally hands off. Everybody did what they wanted. So
it has to be liberating for him at that point.
Well, yeah. But it's like now the story had moved forward for different people in different ways. And so we'd do 35 minutes each group each night and then watch from the wings and see what the other people were doing, because it always was surprising and funny.
How do you decide what to work on when, forgive me for assuming, when money's no longer your primary concern?
That's a correct assumption, fortunately, and fortuitously. It's whatever floats your boat at that point, you know. It's like the Nixon thing came up because I had seen the Frost-Nixon movie, and I thought, and I hadn't seen a lot of fictional depictions of Nixon, but I saw that one, and I thought it was brilliant on Frost, but I thought, that's not the Nixon I know. Nixon, I thought, was in danger of turning into sort of a standard movie villain, you know, you kids get off my lawn kind of guy. And I wanted to sort of correct the record on that. But I have another project that I've been trying to make for years, which is either a stage form, or I've written a film adaptation of it, a musical comedy about the life of J. Edgar Hoover, who I think is another one of the major American characters of the 20th century who has so set the table for what we're living through now. Because if you think we're living in a surveillance state now, all of that was set in motion by J. Edgar Hoover and his files and his wiretapping and his listening in on stuff.
And he was active for like 40 years, right?
He was in power for 50 years. He had more power for more time than anybody in American history. And I thought about it recently. I did a little movie, an independent film, a comedy about the Bohemian Grove, which is this super secret, not so secret, retreat for the richest and most powerful white men in America every summer. And then I did the Nixon series, and now I'm thinking I want to get the J. Edgar thing done. And I realized, oh, that's my little trilogy about American power, because power fascinates me, you know. I guess that's why when I was a kid I wanted to be the grown-up, because of power. So now I'm fascinated by the grown-ups who have the power.
I was interested in the fact that you had all this obvious talent as a child, but your initial career instincts were to do, you did journalism, you worked in the legislature in California, mm-hmm. You taught for a couple of years. Mm-hmm. Was there something about you that felt like you needed to resist whatever artistic impulses you had?
No, I think I was just, I liked education. I was really good in school. It was a very serious topic for us in my family. My family were Eastern European immigrants who came to this country. I think they wanted me to have a possibly serious but certainly productive career, and show business is, you know, notoriously fickle. No parent wishes their kid to go into show business, I don't think. So for a while I was following those kind of hints. And then I went, no, not me.
Did you grow up speaking another language at home?
No, I grew up speaking English, but I was very good at languages. So I spent 5 years learning speaking Spanish, a couple years French, and then I spent 5 years in university learning Russian. And I went to Prague right before the Russians came back in and spoke Russian with all these kids that I met. And now I can't. You know, I run into Russian speakers every once in a while. The guy I was doing the play with in London was a Russian speaker. And I can say, you know, hi, how are you? The doctor is not home. And that's about it.
Do you think there's something about the risks you have to take as a performer that do make you willing to, you know, so many people study language and then they're not confident about speaking a foreign language because they feel like they're going to make a mistake?
Mm. Well... It to me, it's just all about wanting to be understood, you know, and wanting to understand. And if you're if you're thrown into a place where not a lot of people speak English and you have learned this language, it's not even a choice. You got to do it. You know, it's like when you're thrown in the water and you got to swim, because that's a bad example, because you really do have to learn.
And most people don't.
Yeah, right.
In that situation.
But, you know, it's just you want – or at least I want to be understood and want to communicate. So it wasn't even, oh, I'm embarrassed about my accent or anything like that. It's just, I can try this and see if it gets across. And if it does, I'll keep doing it.
Has your voice changed a lot over, you know, the decades since your adulthood?
I don't know. I haven't listened to myself in my 20s lately. I think I've listened every once in a while to old radio shows of mine, and I've changed the way I talk to the audience, I think. I didn't feel comfortable for a long time being myself in public. I really wanted to be characters, and I wanted to be known for characters. And so my I think I was tentative in being a version of myself in public, and I've long since gotten over that. But I think that would be the main difference, is I think I know a lot more about how to be me.
And it's not a character version of you, it's you?
Well, everybody's public persona, right, is a character version of themselves. That's why it's easy to do for me to do impersonations or characterizations is because, especially people on television, they're not only doing an edited version of themselves to start with because that's their public person, but then as you go through life in television, there are always people in your ear going, that thing you do is great, and do less of that. And so they start honing and basically making caricatures of themselves, and then I just pick up on that.
Do you think a celebrity and the things that go with it in this country, does it ultimately kind of chip away for people at their ability to just do art?
Well, I think it chips away at your ability to observe. Mm-hmm. Sure. I'm fortunate that I have just the right amount of celebrity to, you know, get a little bit of recognition and nice reactions from people. But I can still walk around unobserved and do my observing.
Maybe until you open your mouth?
Maybe until I open my mouth. I was in a Whole Foods a couple years ago and feeling very anonymous. And the checker said, paper or plastic? And I said, paper, please. And the person behind me said, Principal Skinner? So, yeah, until I open my mouth.
Let's go back to the phones now. We have John on the line in Hillsboro. Hi, John.
Hi, Harry. Longtime fan, first-time caller. I really miss the Saddam Hussein impersonator you interviewed. And I wonder, in the post-Saddam years, if he'll ever come back.
Yeah, I had him. He was a character called Shab Shab. Saddam Hussein was notorious for having 32 lookalikes that he would send out to public appearances because he was so, not paranoid, afraid of assassination. And so I made up this character called Shab Shab based on a bad contractor that I had working on my house. You know, you take from life. And they talk like this, and they would always call me up on the phone, Mr. Sharir. but I had him call me up within the last 3 months. So he's still around. He, you know, he was, now that Saddam's not around, he was thinking about having plastic surgery to look more like Maliki, but now Maliki's gone. And he has a sideline, which is he sells high-end stereo equipment, but that business is not going so well in Iraq these days either. People do not want the KEF speakers. They do not want the B&Ws. They want to have the little earbuds, Mr. Schitter, in case their ears get blown off.
you never get confused from switching from one voice to the next?
No, not until very late in life, I hope, if you know what I mean. No, I analogize it to songs. If you ask people to sing a song, they'll probably pick the one out of their brain that accords with that request and not confuse it with others. I think it's sort of the similar thing.
Yeah. When you do Nixon, you have a pretty extensive prosthetic makeup mm-hmm, job mm-hmm. With the nose and everything. Did you know you wanted to do that? Or
Oh, yeah. I'm sort of obsessed with the idea of disappearing into characters. It was one of the sources of my trouble at Saturday Night Live is they didn't care about that. I mean, Dan Aykroyd played Nixon with a mustache on, you know.
Right.
Chevy Chase didn't make any attempt to look like Gerald Ford. They don't care. And I care. Mm-hmm. I care about that. I don't have any fun doing a character and not looking like him. To me, that's what stand-up comics do. You know, I think he looks something like this, and you know, he rubs his face and scrunches up. I want to be much more vivid than that. It helps me. I think it may help the audience, but it certainly helps me. So yeah, absolutely. I wanted and. We did the pilot. We didn't get to do a makeup test in the pilot, so the first time I wore the makeup was the first day we shot. We realized that was not the best way to approach professional work.
You have to get used to feeling it on your skin.
Well, and you have to look at it under the lights and see if it's working. Mm-hmm. So the third for the series, we did 3 separate makeup tests and kept working on the look. And yeah, I mean, when I see it in the mirror, and then I see, you know, Nixon wore custom made suits, so I had them get me a couple of custom-made suits that really, you know, so I could really see the body inside the suit. And when I saw the prosthetics and I saw my body in the suit, that's when I could start to really do the work. I'm sorry, I come from the outside. It's not what actors are supposed to do, but I do it.
Is there something about, did you watch tapes of him? Obviously, there weren't videotapes of the things that you're reproducing for the series. But
except for the pre-resignation.
For the speech.
Yeah.
Yeah. Did you watch things in a different way to get the movements down?
No, I had incorporated them years earlier. I mean, I'd watch this guy. He was president of the United States, for God's sake. I saw way too much of him. And then, you know, probably I did a piece for NBC where it was the first time in the 90s. It was a long-forgotten show, and the piece never aired anyway. But I did the piece with the makeup woman who went on to do all of Jim Carrey's makeup, so it was the first time I got to do full-on Nixon on television the way I wanted to do it. And for that, I think I did some studying. But for this, I think it was all in me by this point.
Full-on Nixon. I mean, on the one hand, it's got to be, you know, I mean, when you were 25, that would be like the worst thing ever to imagine yourself that way.
Well, you know, again, I was doing political satire at the time. I was acting in critique of the decisions and the policies. And the man was sort of secondary to that. The man is the way in to that kind of critique. I always feel I want to have a way into the character to do the critique. So, for example, during the era of George W. Bush, to me, what was salient about that administration was he was not the guy his father had adopted, you know, had anointed as the chosen one. It was Jeb, and there was a lot to me under the surface of okay, see. In the way he conducted his administration, in the way he denigrated the UN, his father had been an ambassador to the UN, in the way he blamed the CIA for so-called intelligence failures, his father had run the CIA. All of it could be read as sort of messages to his dad. You know,
it's very Shakespearean when you couch it that way.
So that was the way I tried to see it. I try to see it through some kind of prism of understanding who the guy is, but then to make the comic critique of what's going on. But in this show, there's no critique of policy. There's no discussion of politics or anything like that. It's purely about what a strange, funny guy this was.
Do you enjoy free, unscheduled time where you really have nothing going on?
No.
How do you feel it?
I'm not a good relaxer. My wife is the same way. My wife, I mentioned her earlier. I should say her name, Judith Owen, wonderful singer, songwriter. She's the same way. She loves her work. She adores playing music and adores being a performer. Last year, we looked at each other and said, we have to take some time off. So we went to an elephant reserve in Botswana for 10 days and just lived with elephants. In normal life, I play basketball. If I can't play basketball, I swim, I do yoga, or I play play bass. I love to play bass just recreationally. I read. I can't just sit around.
Harry Shearer is an actor, writer, and director in town to receive the Ernie Kovacs Award at Dallas Video Fest 27. His new series, Nixon's the One, debuts on YouTube October 21st. Harry, it has been such a pleasure to have you here. Thank you.
It's been my pleasure.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer with help on the phones today from Christina Ulsh. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.